Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host. So today, we're going to be talking about investing in notes. This is one of my more favorite asset classes, one that probably most people aren't aware of, because they just think notes are boring. But we actually have a guest on. We have Eddie Speed. How are you doing today, Eddie?
I'm great. How are you, Kurt?
I'm doing great. I'm glad we had a chance to bring you on. I've known about you for a while. You know, you run a note thing called the Note School, where you help people get educated about notes. And I love the concept. I think it's excellent because there's so many notes out there and people aren't even aware that it's a thing. So Eddie, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, I started buying notes in 1980. So it's about 40 years ago, right? And it's been my career. I've helped a lot of real estate investors create notes. And obviously, if they create a good note, then there's a good note that can be purchased in the marketplace. So I've tried to kind of control my marketplace by helping real estate investors make better notes. And then obviously help investors that don't want to go through all the real estate cycle, but just buy notes, have good notes they could buy.
Let's talk about just notes in general. Why notes? Why not real estate or stocks or why notes? Why did you get into that field? How did you start?
Oh, it was by accident. My father-in-law and a partner were kind of pioneers of buying seller finance notes nationwide. And they were both real estate background guys and had finance background. And in 1980, interest rates were 18% and people were forced to seller finance so that they could make a mortgage payment affordable. So seller financing filled a gap conventional lending didn't fill. So I just fell into it.
Let's talk about notes in general, because there's a lot of different types of notes. So can you talk a little bit about that, the different types that people can invest in?
I've done in 40 years, I mean, I've closed 50,000 transactions. So I've done a lot of different kind of deals, different asset classes, even notes that weren't even secured by real estate. But if you looked at my resume, I am a real estate note buyer. And predominantly, consistently over 40 years is buying seller finance notes. What really happens is, you know, a seller of the property sells his property. And instead of taking all the equity up front, he takes it over time, right? He collects payments over time with interest. And then he owns a note and he can sell that note. The other thing is in this world, it can be a loan where it was originated through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or one of the agencies, but somehow, some reason, the loan did not meet all of their standards. That's a loan that in that industry is called a scratch and dent loan, just like you think about scratch and dent appliances or something. And so there are some of those loans in the marketplace as well, and that supply and demand kind of moves back and forth. But I've obviously bought, you know, and traded a lot of notes like that as well.
So real estate, that's obviously a big one. Are there other types of loans or notes that you've seen or that exist out there?
You can have notes on equipment, or you can have notes on businesses. You can have other notes, other asset classes. I would say that certainly for a passive investor, that a real estate secured note would probably be something that you would attract to the most, because obviously it's got good security with it.
Yeah. And I think people understand real estate and they understand mortgages, right? So it's basically like you're being the bank, right?
You know, I've spoke, gosh, I bet you in front of 200,000 people over my career. I've spoke in front of audiences from Seattle to Miami that were a room full of landlords. And I've said, if all things were equal, would you rather be a landlord or the bank? And guess what? The consistent response was they would rather be the bank.
Yeah.
So that's the idea. And of course, you know, this cycle that we're in produces an interesting perspective about, you know, rental property anyway, right?
Yeah. And I want to get to that in a little bit, but let's talk a little bit about, you know, how they work. You know, I get this question a lot, like, why would somebody go through a private lender as opposed to the bank? Let's kind of talk through that and how these come to pass to begin with.
There's about 100,000 seller finance notes that were written last year. So about 100,000 nationwide. So seller financing can be on property that's a little bit unique, that somehow, some way wouldn't quite meet the traditional underwriting standard. It could be on land. It could be on a package of houses. There's different reasons that maybe somebody chose to sell or finance it. And admittedly, some of those reasons aren't good reasons to buy the note, right? Maybe the property or the buyer just was substandard and nobody would make a loan on it. But there's also some really good reasons that people would own or finance to fill the gap conventional lending doesn't fill, because conventional lending always has a gap it doesn't fill. Right now, well, 35% of the people that could get a traditional mortgage in February can't get one in September.
Why is that?
The mortgage credit availability. Mortgage Bankers Association prints a chart every month and shows you the mortgage credit availability. 35% of the people that could get a mortgage in February cannot get one in September and October.
Is it because they don't qualify or the banks aren't lending, or what's...
It's what they mortgage banking refers to it as the COVID overlay. They tighten their lending criteria.
I've noticed that. I've talked to people who must have been 5 years ago. I was talking to a mortgage broker and I was asking him, I said, so, because I kept hearing stories that small business owners, very flush with cash, couldn't get a mortgage.
Exactly.
And even a refinance where you're not taking cash out, they just, it was just making it really difficult. Versus a W-2, it was easy. But he said to me, he said, you know, there's going to be a time maybe in 2-3 years where if you're a business owner, you're not going to be able to get a mortgage at all. Like, it's gotten that strict. So how does that kind of work in? Because that to me doesn't make sense, because business owners have, a lot of them have good cash flow.
Let me say that I believe the mortgage servicing and mortgage banking industry is looking over the horizon and they don't like what they see. And I think traditional people selling real estate or sales oriented, and maybe they just are focused on the, you know, the inventory right in front of them, and it's easy to sell a house right at the moment. But the truth of the matter is we got an ugly future ahead of us. And mortgage banking is looking at that. The big banks, if you looked at their loan loss reserves, they're collecting 8 and 10 times the loan loss reserves they were collecting in 2019 this year. So they're bracing up for a big storm. And I believe mortgage banking is bracing up for a big storm. And so they've cut back the minimum credit score, the standards. And the truth be told, right, wrong, or indifferent, the loans that are most likely to have a problem in the mortgage industry are people that are self-employed and people that are getting a residential mortgage for a business purpose. That is a rent house. And the other thing is people with lower credit scores. They've just lopped off the end of their business and they've just eliminated 30% of their business. Now, that's not true absolutely straight across the board. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, they've lopped off about 20%. But Eddie, you said there's 35%. Oh yeah, jumbo mortgages. Their average loan to value in January was like 85%. Their average loan to value today is 65%.
It's a big shift.
I'm a contrarian, right? I'm a seller finance guy. I'm the guy that's waiting for the seeing the banks and mortgage industry make a mistake and leave a void in the market that I can go fill.
And that's a really important point, because the banks have, I don't want to say they've destroyed their business model, but they've certainly been, you know, trying to wreck their car as they're driving around from 2008. And then afterwards, not only did they overlend, now they're underlending business owners. It's hard for them to get financing, or at least so I hear. And what happens is it creates these alternative markets, right? These, you know, this seller financing, these third-party financing institutions that are kind of filling that gap. Let's talk about that a little bit. There's some certainly that have propped up, but like on the private side, are you looking at a lot of these people that are actually taking back paper as they're selling their property? Or are you looking at it as like there are a lot of third-party people walking around saying, hey, I'll lend to you?
Yeah, I'm talking about pure seller financing. Private lending, those, that secondary market is where somebody makes a loan and now they make an equity loan and then they want to sell it in the secondary market. But those loans are typically bought at the full amount of the loan, or even bought at more than the full amount of the loan, like 101 cents on the dollar. The loans that I typically specialize in are seller finance notes, which traditionally, at least when I buy them, I'm buying them at a discount. Discount, how much is the discount? And so that is graded based on the quality of the loan. You know, we've been doing it 40 years. We've got a lot of experience doing it. And so we've kind of got it somewhat to a science. And so I just developed a training company about 20 years ago because I learned two things. I learned that a real estate investor creating notes did not instinctively know how to create a note that fit the secondary market for notes, right? He knew how to create a note in his mind, but he didn't know really the right ingredients to the pie, so to speak. So I developed the note system for Homebesters. You remember those guys, the Ugly House guys? I developed their note system like in the 1991. So I've been doing this forever, you know, showing like a real estate investor the formula how to make notes. But then, you know, they need liquidity, right? They run out of money. And then they need to go to the market and sell some of those loans or sell all of those loans. And so I've made a market helping real estate investors so that I could supply the marketplace with notes that could be bought that are better grade of notes than the generic market would go make on its own. Then on the other side is, to be honest with you, I've been in this 40 years and I've had my back broke, figuratively speaking, about three times because of institutional money. So I swore off institutional money in 2008 and said, I don't have a line of credit at the bank. Honestly, I don't buy any loans that I sell to institutional investors. I have institutional investors that I deal with, but I don't buy any loan anticipating that they're going to go save me. I deal with private investors.
It's interesting because I know a few people, they got their wholesale lines pulled in the worst time that, you know, it's the time you want a bigger wholesale line to go out and buy all this paper. I remember hearing about Beal Bank. I forget the guy's first name, but
Andy Beal.
Yeah. So hearing the story about him in like 2007 or six, when he just basically just sold off all his paper and just he was a professional gambler for a year or two and waited until the market crashed. And then he started building back up his capital and just went and bought all this discounted paper. I mean, the guy's brilliant.
He is brilliant.
You know, and you think about that, there's these cycles, and this kind of gets into what you were mentioning earlier. There are these cycles, and we do a lot of private mortgages too, and you know, in our firm. And you know, when we're going through it, like we've just seen a lot fewer notes now because it's just we're at the peak of the market, and you tend to see fewer of them, lower quality. But once that cycle turns, it's going to be an avalanche. So maybe you could kind of tell us a little bit about the cycle, where we are, how that works with the notes, just from your experience, because you've obviously been through a few of these.
I do a lot of state of the industry things, and I'm deeply involved in about three of the four biggest real estate investor masterminds in the United States. I've been texting literally this morning the leaders of three of those masterminds with this very theory that I'm going to give you. The example is mortgage credit availability. If you're in my business and we pay attention to the news press related to mortgage underwriting and financing and all that stuff daily, this is all common knowledge. We walk around our office every day just knowing that's a factor. I deal with guys that buy hundreds of houses a year and none of them know that mortgage credit availability has been wiped out. They don't know that because all they know right now at the moment is that every realtor they know is slammed, and every time they put a property on the market, there's 20 offers. How can you go wrong? John Burns, who I assume you know who he is, he's probably one of the most recognized residential real estate consultants for every big money firm in the country, from Fannie to Freddie to every big bank and every big home builder. He calls it a dead cat bounce. And I think that's exactly where we are. We have a lack of listings. But if you remember 2008, Kirk, what happened and what became the topic was called shadow inventory. Remember that term?
Oh, yeah.
So shadow inventory was the inventory that was going to hit the market but hadn't hit the market. So let me give you some math. There's cumulatively about 7 million trouble loans in the market. Half of them are in forbearance and half of them are 90 plus days delinquent. Okay, now this is according to mortgage bankers and any, you know, CoreLogic or any data source out there. So this is all easily researchable. So we have about 7 million loans that are in trouble. They're just frozen in the air. In addition to that, we had 18 million residential rental doors, more than we have in 2010. And let me just tell you something. There's a good percentage, maybe it's 30%, maybe it's 40%, it's sure more than 10, that you have unhappy landlords. And by the way, they're not collecting their rent. Recently, HousingWire did a great article about this, like laying it out. And it's what I call the amateur burnout landlord. And think about it, because they can afford to sell. the landlord that has equity, and all of a sudden he's frustrated in the market, like he tells his realtor, just sell it. And they said, whoa, but the market's dropping and it might go down, you know, 10%. He said, sell it. He can afford to sell. That combination of problem loans and combination of burnout landlords, that is a killer shadow inventory on the horizon. To me, that's what mortgage banking is looking at.
I guess I didn't give mortgage lenders all that much credit.
Well, mortgage lenders tend to be analytical, not the sales reps. Okay, the sales reps are salespeople. And honestly, I'm not disrespecting them, but they don't read all the rags that we do. They're sales guys. The guys that are running these servicing shops, they are analyticals. I mean, they're not, a lot of times they're not great communicators because they're very analytical people. Trust me, I've been in enough mortgage bankers conferences and, you know, had to tell them to lean up and talk in the mic better. But they're brilliant. And I'm saying to you, they're analytical and they're looking at this going, what's on the next horizon? And this is a little bit scary, but in this situation, answer the question every step of the way. Do you want to buy a rent house if you think the market is sliding in value? No. So what's the best alternative to a rent house? Investing in a note. Oh, wait a minute. I don't want to buy a note because it's sliding in value. The buyer has equity. The thing about the note business is if the property is worth $300,000, you're investing $200,000 in that note. You're not investing $300,000. So there's a cushion factor built into it. So now all of a sudden you have money turning in a different direction because people are, you know, let's be fair about it. People bought the dream of buying rental properties. They did not buy a reality of what a lot of it consists of. They don't get the checks they thought they were going to get. You know, people talk about TNT, right? Tenants and toilets. Everybody's heard that. I say there's only one T. That's tolerance. So a lot of people bought the investment with not the tolerance. Nothing wrong with rentals. You just have to have a tolerance for it.
Yeah, there's a certain type of, I call it the landlord mindset. If you've met one landlord, they all sound the same. They all smell the same. They've got the same mentality. They can squeeze a nickel. I mean, they're just a certain type. There's nothing wrong with it. I just find it funny that they're all of that type. And you kind of have to be to make it work. I mean, you've got to be really expense conscious. You have to really know how to deal with people that are, in my state, Massachusetts, it is tenant friendly, one of the worst states, because it'll take you 6 months to get rid of a bad tenant when it's not COVID related. You know, and if it's over the winter, forget about it. You can add another 4 or 5 months on there. So it's tough being a landlord. And we're actually starting to see that. We're having, you know, people call us saying, hey, I'm in this rental. I'm not feeling like it's a good thing. I want to look for something else. So I hear you. Like, that is definitely starting to see it.
Well, it's a pattern, right? I run a business, run a training business, and who shows up? It just became the obvious conclusion. It's not brilliance. It's just a guy that's fairly seasoned in a business, and we're just trying to listen to our audience. And our audience has identified this. And so we've clearly seen this as a mark. And I've called this scenario of these landlords with equity being shadow inventory. I've actually been identifying this for over 2 years. Now, all of a sudden, Housing Wire and other publications are coming out with real specific information about percentages of the landlords that what I call the amateur landlords, right? I mean, the professional landlords have an underwriting standard. They have a process. And the truth be told, they have an experienced giant slippage in collecting rent. I run in these masterminds, and those guys are like, we're 95% of what we were collecting in February. But I remind them, I said, yes, but you're a professional landlord with professional underwriting standards. Your competition is a guy that doesn't have the rules and the disciplines that you have. Is, as you said, you know how these guys talk. I mean, they're really engineer, accountant type personalities, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of people that bought rentals were promoted the real estate.
That I agree with. There's a ton of people promoting real estate. And I know in Boston, there's like for commercial buildings, like a 2 cap for buildings. Yeah. And people are lining up. I mean, before COVID anyway, they were lining up to fight for that 2 cap. And I like shake my head and think like, what are you doing? Like, you just have a bag of money you got to put somewhere, like stick it under your mattress. Yeah, I wanted to get into, because this kind of gets into an interesting part of the process, is like, How do you price risk with a note? Because obviously there's risks in everything. So how do you price the risk when you're looking at purchasing a note?
Well, my theory is, you know, I'm buying imperfect notes, right? Because if they were perfect, they would have a Fannie Mae loan on them or a Freddie Mac loan or an FHA loan, right? That's perfect. And I'm buying less than perfect. But when is it perfect enough? And so the theory is there's redeeming factors. I'm in your camp that a lot of people will be seller financed with a significant down payment because they're self-employed, not because they're an inordinate risk. But they can't document themselves. Listen, I tried to refi. My wife and I owe about 40% of what our house is worth. 40%. We have perfect credit. Let's just say I'm fairly sure I qualify income-wise. I got 8 companies. We send in the stuff and the loan officer, you can imagine, just falls over dead. They're not fixing to underwrite me. They got too many easy deals to work for this guy to come in with 8 companies and combined financials and blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff. And they just can't, they're not going to figure it out. Like Fannie Mae basically tells the loan underwriter, we really want you to have audited financials on self-employed. Audited financials. I mean, no, it's in Fannie Mae's guidelines. They made it a guideline about 60 days ago. So understand this, all this kind of stuff has produced a gap for guys like us, right? To say, hey, there's an opportunity. So what is the risk? Well, listen, I've collected a lot of paper in my years, right? The guy that runs my operation, Bob Repass, he oversaw a $2 billion portfolio of seller finance notes for 20 straight years, first at the Associates, later at Bayview. So we don't lack any experience around my shop with guys that have had to go collect all these loans that they bought. And so we're not looking for high-risk loans. Yes, credit is a factor. So, Eddie, you're saying you'll never buy a loan with a customer had bad credit. Well, what's the redeeming factor? Okay, I have a perfect pay history for the last 4 years. Does that override some bad credit? Yeah. So there's variables within a note. There's 6 characteristics that influence the value of the note. The qualifications of the buyer, and that could be his credit, his character, his capacity, his ability to make money, right? Then there's the collateral, which is the property itself. We've been talking about residential, but I bought notes on everything from a junkyard to a mansion. And obviously, we're going to see a huge amount of seller financing on commercial property in the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. So the collateral, the next thing is the buyer's equity. That could be equity they've gained over owning it over time, or it could be the down payment they made. The next characteristic is the terms of the loan, which is the interest rate that it's written at and how long it takes to pay back. The next variable, which is a huge variable in my industry, which is the pay history. In other words, how long they've paid and how well they've paid. And then the last thing is the paperwork, how it's written, because seller financing sometimes means a little homemade and there's degrees of homemade. And sometimes you can live with it and sometimes you can't.
What happens if somebody holds a note and they stop paying for one reason or another? What do you do at that point?
There's 3 things you can do with somebody that gets in default. You can give them a new start in life and you can modify the loan. And if they're there and if they have some ability to start over, we're really flexible in letting them do that. We're not looking to go try to foreclose on them. We are going to make sure they have income. We are going to make sure they're going to have a desire to get this thing straight going forward. So we can modify the loan. So the second alternative is if they can't repay, they don't have a good chance of getting themselves straightened back up, then obviously what we want to do with them is have a relationship with them and let them leave with dignity. And that's basically for them to deed the property back to us. Cash for keys, deed in lieu of foreclosure, you'll hear it called different things. We've been very successful at that over the years. Now, the mortgage banking industry in the last cycle, the last debacle, mortgage banking industry did not a good job of really driving this opportunity for sellers. I can get into some theories of why I think that was the case, but the answer is it is a very realistic alternative that the customer will much rather deed it to you than end up with seeing, you know, their name in the newspaper or their name in the courthouse or their name on a sheriff's letter to go deliver it to the door. So we just try to give them an alternative that lets them do that. So deeding it back is a real alternative as a solution. And then the last, of course, would be just simply to, if none of those first two options work, then obviously you can progress with a legal action called a foreclosure.
So when you talk about like a deed in lieu or cash for keys, does that actually go in their credit history if you have to do that? Or does that kind of...
My choice.
Oh, it's your choice.
I can report it and I can structure it in such a way that I can also structure it in such a way that they don't have any tax consequences. You know, if you default on your loan and you don't pay it back and the lender is unable to liquidate it foreclosure, then you've accepted money for a mortgage and didn't pay it back. The IRS considers that income, forgiveness of debt.
That is a huge kick in the head for a lot of people after the 2008, you know, they get foreclosed and, oh, by the way, you didn't have any money. We're just going to give you this big tax bill on top of it. I mean, that's
why deed in lieu is such a valuable tool. And you don't do it as a lever. You can't do it like if you don't do this, I'm going to do this. But it is a great tool. Anyway, I believe the short sale specialty servicing is what prohibited deed in lieus in the last cycle. I believe that driving that industry is what really caused that. And I just would say that we've been very successful doing deed in lieus.
You know, as we get into this, what I would call a down cycle, obviously having a big enough cushion is helpful. But how do you handle that? Because 2008, I mean, you had to have a real big cushion, big margin compared to where it ended up from where it started. So how do you kind of look at as going into the cycle where people, if they're buying notes or creating notes, like how can they prepare for that so they can kind of think ahead?
Even in the worst of times, most people don't default on their mortgage. In 2008, which is the most loan defaults we've seen since the Great Depression, there were 12% of mortgages that were in delinquency, right? 12%, which means 88% were paying. Well, subprime lending lent money to a lot of people in the early 2000s that were not people you and I would have lent money to. Somehow we forget the fact that the most important principle in lending is character. Just because somebody's house goes down in value doesn't mean that they default. The theory is, you know, Kurt, you and I are the same, I think, in the fact that we've lived through cycles where our house went down in value and we didn't panic. We just, there were roses in the flower bed and that's just where we wanted to live. We made right. Our mortgage payment and life went on, right?
Yep.
So I would say that we have a set of lens that we look through a deal and just say, is the person that owes this money, are they of the character that just because their house drops in value, that they don't freak out and run off? So that's number one. And number two, statistically, yes, even in the worst of times, you'll see defaults, but it's not 25% of everybody out there defaults. If you start out with the right kind of loans that weren't high risk loans to start with, then I think you'll see that those loans will season and model pretty well through any cycle. That's been our experience.
So one question that comes up, and I've talked to a lot of people in the real estate industry about this, and I find it interesting because, you know, I look at the real estate cycles and the Fed has squeezed things so much with low interest rates. You know, it's really hard to see what is going to turn the real estate cycle. There's a need for more housing. There's low interest rates, the affordability, you can kind of go down the list. Like, what in your mind is going to turn the real estate cycle into a down cycle, which at some point we need to have, but everything seems to be kind of so high. What do you see as kind of one way that would potentially happen?
The shadow inventory that we talked about is definitely a factor. Right now, we have a shortage of listings, and it gives us a false sense of real estate. That's why people don't notice the fact that basically a third of the people that could get a mortgage in February can't get one today because there's such a demand that the title company industry has been calling this process of deals going under contract and not closing. They've been referring to this for years as a fractured closing. So now all of a sudden, National Association of Realtors last month, their tally was about 30% of the deals that were under contract was a fractured closing, meaning it didn't close. So it's not that we're not seeing signs of all of the things that I'm saying. I'm saying the fact that there's a lack of listings has all to do with this market. So people thought that low interest rates were going to have this amazing effect on residential property, but that really, other than refis, that really doesn't seem to have been that measurable of a thing.
listeners might be thinking like, hey, this is interesting. Like, I want to know more about this. They want to get started in this. Where can they really learn about note investing? I know you have some resources, but there's so many places they could start. Like, where should somebody go to like start to learn about this?
We will address over time, like the theory of where real estate is and the safety of it and the safety of investing your capital and knowing it's safe and getting a, not just getting your return, but a return of your capital too, right? But what I like to do is give people something, and I did a special URL for your podcast listeners that is noteschool.com/moneytree. You know, it's just a URL. So you just type it in, noteschool.com/moneytree. And then basically what we'll do is we'll take that off into like what you can do with tax advantaged accounts like IRAs, Coverdell educational accounts, all of those different kinds of things. Although you can invest money, just your private capital, but you can also do every one of these things with tax advantaged accounts. Then we'll talk about just what is buying a note look like. And we'll have a little training and show you like a specific example, showing a note. Hey, what if you want to do some leveraging with it? Is that possible? And, you know, just show people some simple, basic ideas to then they get a sense of, oh, yeah, I like this. This sounds like it fits me.
Now you're speaking my language, Eddie, when you talk about investing in notes and retirement accounts. That's what we do.
I think every IRA administration company out there would tell you that this is the best single investment they see people do is buy notes.
Yeah, it's definitely a simpler version than buying real estate for sure. You don't have the headaches of being a landlord, but you still get monthly payments. So that's why we like it. I don't want to say it's less risk, but it's in many ways less maintenance. And it's just a different asset class to consider. So as we kind of wrap it up here, Eddie, any final thoughts we haven't covered you think the listeners need to know?
There's a pattern. And I would say whether it's you or any other seasoned person that I know in business, the older we get, the more we tend to attract to paper and less we tend to attract to real estate. And the pattern is I've seen it's because you can scale yourself and it's just a lot more passive and you can limit your risk more with owning the note than you can owning the real estate. And so I just think that's a common theme that I see. And I think you mentioned that today. This is a common conversation I have.
We're now getting into the panel portion of the show. We're going to interview our panelists. We have our very own Barbara Friedberg. How are you doing today, Barb?
Hey, Kirk. I'm doing great. Excited to talk about notes. I think this is an interesting area for our listeners and something we don't cover enough.
Yeah, and we're going to let Barb do the Q&A in this part of the show today. So, and we also have our very own Megan Gorman.
Hi, Kirk. I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing well. So, Barb, before you start asking questions, I know there were some terms here that probably people needed to understand going into this.
Eddie discussed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and just want to make sure that you don't think Freddie Mac is another brand of sandwich at McDonald's, but understand actually what these two institutions are. And they are federally backed home mortgage companies, and they're created by the U.S. Congress, but they don't actually originate the mortgages. In other words, they don't actually create them. They buy and guarantee mortgages issued through other lenders. And so the reason for the existence of these institutions is pretty much to give access to maybe less financially secure individuals or properties that have a little bit lower value, give access to mortgages for people that might not ordinarily be able to get a mortgage. And so you'll hear those terms bandied about quite a bit.
So I'm going to hand over the reins to you today, Barb. So why don't you ask the questions?
Awesome. Kirk, I'm going to start with you. What the heck is a note?
Just going right for the throat. Awesome. So basically a note for the listeners here, think of the note as fixed income or a bond. If you think about a mortgage as an example, right? A mortgage is a note. So you have your home and you own it outright, but you also didn't pay for cash for the home. You went out to a bank and you got a mortgage. And that is basically a loan off of your house. Your house is secured by that loan so that if you don't pay it back, the bank can take your house. So that is the security that is involved in that loan. And you borrow the money for a period of time and then eventually you pay it back. That is an example of a note. A bond, they'll say a corporate bond or a treasury, right, that you might find in the stock market. Those are also considered notes in a similar fashion. They're basically fixed income. Many of them are plain vanilla, but they can also get a little crazy too. So depending on the type of note, they can be plain vanilla of just some person borrows money and they pay you interest, or it could be something as complex as, you know, there's some sharing of equity or some other, you know, some other hybrid version of it. But we want to keep it a little bit plain vanilla here, just not to confuse everybody.
Perfect. So it's pretty much you're investing in a loan. So that's another asset class that we typically don't cover. Megan, have you ever invested in notes or recommended those for your clients? And if so, where do you find them?
I have had people invest in notes, but it is often ones that come up through a more personal relationship. So they're trying to achieve something specific. Like, it has not been uncommon where I have clients that want to do notes with like construction builders to buy property and so on. And so one of the discussions, you know, part of it, there's sort of a two-part process with it. The first is doing due diligence to make sure this is an investment we want to make. But the second is, where do we want to put it in the asset allocation? You know, a lot of times I would make the argument a note should be in the fixed income allocation. However, I think it's important to look at it in terms of credit quality and maturity and make sure it matches up with what other holdings the client has. And Kirk, I'm assuming you run into the same thing too when you're building out asset allocations.
Yeah, and I think it's an important question because when you look at notes, you know, you might initially think, well, this is just fixed income. It's like a bond in your portfolio. Mm-hmm. And it can be, right? And I think if you look at it at face value, that's what it is. But sometimes that may not be the reason you're doing it. For instance, we do it for income. That is our primary focus when we're doing notes. We want consistent, reliable income. We're not doing it for the reasons that I'm going to be talking about. But there are many people that make this part of their business. So for example, there are people who buy troubled paper. It's paper that may be in, the borrower has not made payments, it's going into foreclosure, or for whatever reason, it's not really a high quality note. It's not seasoned properly, somebody's not making payments. And you might look at that and say, well, it's worth $100,000, but I'm going to have to foreclose on it. And I'm going to have to pay for legal fees and all that. So I'm not going to pay you $100,000 for that note. I might pay you $50,000, just as an example. Well, if you clean that up and make it work, now all of a sudden you just made a 50% profit. There are people who make a living doing things like that. You could call them hard money lenders. You could call them loan sharks. I mean, there's lots of derogatory names that people use to describe them. But in essence, similar to what happens in the high yield bond market, you know, depending on expertise of your portfolio of high yield bonds, some people look at that as knowing that they're going to pay a discount and regardless the worst case scenario, they'll still make money. Some people in distressed debt make a lot of money doing that. In the private note market, some people operate in the same way with distressed debt. We don't do it that way because it requires a huge ton of effort. There's a lot of variability in there and there's certainly more risk in there. And, you know, there's a lot of things you just can't predict. So we just like consistency of income, which is why we don't do it that way. But it is a profitable method, and there are plenty of people who do it. I would just say in terms of where it falls in the asset class, it really depends on your goal. If your goal is appreciation and growth, then you might be open to ways investing like that. If your goal is strictly income, then you probably don't want to play around with that market because, you know, if for whatever reason you have to foreclose on somebody on their property, their investment property typically, then you may not want to have to deal with that when you're expecting your income this month, you know, to pay for your retirement expenses. So it's really important to understand what the goal is with the investments to see where it fits in the asset allocation bucket.
Okay, Kirk, big question. I'm an investor listening to the show. Where do I sign up? Where can I buy these notes? We're doing all this conversation, but I don't know where to go to find a note to purchase.
It depends on what you're trying to do. I mean, certainly finding somebody who understands it and does it, whether it's through an advisor or whether it's through a fund or a portfolio, is one path that people can take. And if you really don't know what you're doing, that might be the best path. It's something you really need to understand the space because there's just a lot of pieces to it. However, if you're a do-it-yourselfer and you really want to get into the space yourself, there are many places to go. What I find to be the most common place that people go is they'll go to, like, every state has a local real estate investor group. And that is a good place to start because there are plenty of people there that are looking for money and there are plenty of people looking to loan money. So you can learn a lot from that community. There are people there that will teach you, you know, obviously be careful if you don't know what you're doing before you invest. But there are definitely people there who are looking to teach you because just like what Eddie does, I mean, the thing I really like about Eddie, I mean, he spent a lot of time building up his community and educating people to invest in notes the right way. And you might think, well, why would he do that? That's a waste of time. And what I would argue is, in talking to Eddie at other times, like, he really wants good quality notes out there. Because at the end of the day, he's not going to be able to find every note. And you and I aren't going to be able to find every note. I mean, there's billions of dollars in notes being created out there. And if you want to buy one, you want to make sure it's good quality. So what he's trying to do is build a community who are creating good quality notes. And whether they perform or not, perform meaning that they're paying the monthly bill, the interest on it. If they perform, then that's great. If they don't perform, you can't predict that. But at least if somebody has to go in and foreclose or take it over, like, you know, the quality of notes good. It's just the borrower maybe just came upon hard times or what have you. So a lot of times that these lenders will actually do a workout. And a workout is basically, all right, you owe us this money, you haven't been paying. Let's figure out how to make this work for you. Most people think about notes, they think, oh, I don't want to do that because I don't want to foreclose on somebody and kick them out of their home. And that's just not, you know, good karma. You know, people do that. But in general, what I find is the professional note investors prefer not to do that because really nobody wins. And the person who's getting evicted is mad. So they destroy their house on the way out and they take their time. It's easier just to work with them and to figure it out. So maybe you have to take the payments and just add them back to the end into the principal and say, all right, well, let's just start from scratch. Let's start next month. You make your payments. We'll tack what you owe onto the end and we'll just start afresh. Because no one wants this to go into court, into foreclosure. It doesn't benefit anybody. So workouts are something that happen frequently. And so I think if you look at it as the market is really about solving a problem, right? Is somebody needs to borrow money. They can't necessarily get in the traditional way for many different reasons that happens, which we can talk about. But generally there are many, they're not getting it the traditional way and they need access to funds. So real estate investor groups are one. People like Eddie, Eddie's one, but there's a bunch of other people out there who have these communities of people who are involved with notes. You know, that's a good place to start. Also, if you have a certain, we've been talking about real estate, but people can have notes in all sorts of ways. I mean, it could be equipment leasing. It could be just about anything. I mean, think about any sort of place that you borrow money. There are plenty of ways to lend money to people. And it's as long as you're doing it properly and you're basing it on an asset, so nobody can just walk away without paying you, then you'll be protected. But effectively, there's a lot of different creative ways, and I'm not sure how much time we have on the show to get into it all, but just look in your community and just think creatively, because there are people who need money, and if you do it well, then you can make a good return, they can make a good return, and everybody wins.
Now, I want to flip over just a bit and share another way that you can invest in notes and debt, both attached with real estate as collateral or real estate mortgages as collateral, because maybe you just don't even feel like doing the legwork of finding an investor group or finding someone that's doing these kind of off the books type of situations. You can invest in a real estate investment trust or REIT that invests in mortgages. And that's as simple as buying or selling a stock. And you can get income and possibly appreciation as well for those. Additionally, many new crowdfunding platforms are cropping up where you can pool your money with other investors to invest in a variety of different types of loans. and Prosper Lending Club and many other investment platforms such as Roofstock and other sorts of sites offer the opportunity to invest in debt that is makes it accessible for the smaller investor. Now, Megan, what are the risks of investing in notes and consumer debt and mortgage debt?
The risk is default. What is the likelihood of default? And I think that what you have to do is look at, well, how do you do diligence with regular types of fixed income instruments, right? So when you're investing in a bond fund or you have a bond manager, typically what you're paying for with those managers is their ability to monitor the credit quality and likelihood of default. When you do these types of investments, sometimes the transparency isn't always there. So what I would tell anyone is when you're taking on this risk, you also want to make sure that you're being compensated for the risk that you're taking on, because some of this will have a higher degree of likelihood of default. And so if you're going to do that, get paid for it.
Wonderful and very important tips. And unlike bonds, which usually come with a credit rating from an A on down, some of these products do not have a credit rating. So you need to be aware of what percentage of your note investing might go south and how much might you lose. So Kirk, I'd like to turn it back over to you and ask, is there anything we've missed on this topic or that you'd like to add?
The risk part is really important, and you need to be able to price. If you're lending money, you need to be able to price it accordingly. I'll give you an example. You know, there are some hard money lenders out there, and there are a lot of them circulating at these real estate groups too, and you got to be careful of these people. They're not bad people, but they're sharp. You know, they're people that you want to make sure you know what you're doing if you're working with them, because they're going to price it the best way for them. So what a lot of these people will do, just as some insight, is they go in. So let's say I own a piece of property. Let's say it's worth $100,000 and I want to borrow $70,000, or let's say $50,000. Let's just make it easy. So I want to borrow $50,000 to acquire this property from somebody because I can get it at a deal. This person will say, all right, I'll loan you $50,000 and I want like 15% interest rates as an example. And I also want a few points. I want 3 points. Now, a point is basically 1% of the value of the loan, and you pay it up front. If you've done a mortgage, you know what points are, but it's basically you're paying up front a certain amount, you know, plus you're paying the rate of interest. Now,
Kirk, let me interrupt you for a moment here.
Go ahead.
Because 15% sounds awfully high. Can you explain to the listeners why a borrower would be willing to pay 15% for a real estate loan?
Yes, I will answer that in a second. Let me finish my point. That's a great question. So what happens is when I'm going in, I'm saying, all right, I'm thinking like, oh, I can take this and I can flip this property and I can make a quick buck. You know, I can flip it in a month. It's going to cost me 3% up front and maybe, you know, whatever, another 1% plus for that month. So I'm looking at it and thinking, all right, that's a good deal for me. The other person is thinking, what's the worst that can happen here? For a lot of lenders, what they'll do is they'll look at it and say, the worst thing that could happen is I have to acquire this property. So they typically go into the situation knowing that they're going to acquire the property. The good part is it may never happen, but they go in expecting it. Because if they go in expecting it, then they're not going to be surprised. So they go in and they price the deal accordingly. They think, all right, I'm going to have to foreclose on this property. I'm going to have to take it over. Am I going to have enough equity? What are the costs to foreclose? They're pricing all of that into the equation. So if you perform, that's great. If you don't perform, they're making sure they don't lose money. So that's how they price it. And it's really important to understand that, because right now, there are a lot of individual investors in this market offering 4, 5, 6% on these, you know, private notes or private mortgages. And it's just not smart, because you're not pricing your risk. If you think about it, let's say you have to foreclose on somebody, it's going to cost you at least a few percent to go through that process. So if you're only getting 4 or 5, you're already behind the eight ball before you even, you know, get the equity of the property to recover your amount. So there's a lot that goes into this. And I guess my point is that you really need to understand the process from both sides as to how people are pricing it so that you can make sure that you're, whether you're borrowing or lending, that you're getting a good deal. Now, Barb, your question of why somebody would pay that, there are actually many reasons. And this is probably one of the most common questions that people ask me when we do this. When you're investing in a private mortgage, there's a few examples. One example is like what I just gave. Let's say I can pick up a property, it's worth $100,000 and I can buy it for $50,000, but I don't have the cash. But I need the cash in like 5 days in order to pick up this property. You go to a hard money lender and just say, here's the deal, here's what I have. Will you loan me the money to pick this up? I have a buyer already in line. They're willing to pay $75 for it. I just need to float the money for 30 days so that I can actually pick up this property and flip it. And for that, that to me is, you know, an example of a deal that somebody might strike to do that. A very common example, which happens a lot in the real estate space, is there are people who do rehabs or fix and flips. There are people who do this. I've actually interviewed one of them on the show about a year and a half ago. I don't know how many he does. He might do like 50 or 100 fix and flips or rehabs a year. I mean, that's a huge amount of those. And a bank is going to look at that person and going to say, I don't want to lend money to that person, you know, because what happens is the person, when they borrow money, they need the money anywhere between 1 day and 30 days in order to close. They typically, they're getting deals because they need liquidity. You know, like, let's just say the bank says, hey, I got this property, I need to get off my books. And you come and say, I'll give it to you for half off. And the bank says, sure, just get it off my books. You can't go in and necessarily just say, oh, I don't have the money, give me 60 days to go get it. The bank's going to say, sorry, bub, I'm going to go to the next person in line who's willing to give me the cash today. So a lot of these deals that they pick up are, they get them because they have the cash to pay them up front. Now, you might be able to get away with that from your bank once or twice, but if you're doing like 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 of these deals a year, the bank is not going to strike you that kind of a deal. Banks will take 30, 60, 90 days to give you a mortgage on the property, and that's just too late. So there's a time element here that they need to take advantage of, and liquidity. They need to be able to get the cash when they want it and if they want it. The other problem with the banks is if you're going for that typical mortgage, maybe it takes, you know, 60 days. Maybe you don't get it at all. Maybe the bank says, sorry, we're not interested after 30 days or 60 days or whatever. Now you're out. Like, you're not getting the deal. So a lot of these people, they need access to secure lines of capital when they need it. I mean, we work with people like this all the time. We don't work with everybody. We work with the same people over and over and over again. So we know them. We know their risks. We know their business model. You know, we understand, in many ways, we've taught some of them how to manage risk better, because we want to make sure that if we're lending money, we want to make sure that, you know, the risks are really low. So there are plenty of good people out there that are just, they specialize in this space. But that's why somebody might pay that kind of a rate, is because they're able to get a lot more benefit on their side, and the paying that rate to them is, it's short money. If they're making 40%, they don't mind paying 15% annually if they're wrapping the property up in like 6 months.
So to sum it up, it sounds like this is an opportunity for investors who really want to find another revenue stream or another diversifier for their portfolio. And you can do a little bit of homework, maybe follow up on Eddie Speed's program and see what he has to offer. Look online for other people that are investing in notes and teaching about notes, or check in your local area to see if there are real estate groups that are involved in this type of investing. Megan, do you have any final words on this topic?
No, I thought Kirk did a fabulous job of explaining it. So, I mean, I think the thing is, I like anything that can generate income, as long as you understand the risks you take on. But, you know, as you can see from just hearing Kirk talk about it, there's a lot of people out there who really, truly understand this, and you want to find those people for advice. You can find me at Twitter, Wealth Intersect, or at thewealthintersection.com. Thanks for having me on.
And my name is Barbara Friedberg. And final thoughts for me are, portfolio diversification is really, really important. And what that means is, if you have more than one type of asset in your overall arsenal of investments, you have a chance of smoothing out the returns. If one class, say stocks, go south, you've got other asset classes that will boost up your returns. So I see the notes as an opportunity to broaden the diversification within your portfolio. You can find me at Barbara Friedberg, Personal Finance, and also at Robo Advisor Pros or on my new Barbara Friedberg YouTube channel. And Kirk, thanks for having me on.
Yep. Thanks for coming on, Barb. Thanks again, Megan. So that's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us for Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. Of course, you can find me every week here on the show. If you want to find more about notes, you can certainly contact me. We do a lot of notes. And, you know, even if you're just looking for just general direction, just let me know. It's something we do a lot of. And I love the space. It's just, especially now when real estate's really expensive. So please remember to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all our show notes, resources, and the archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.